in that meeting when we found out the really bad news, the surgeon described it as having tentacles in Laura's brain. And she said, so like a cancer. And he said, yes, exactly like a cancer. But no one had mentioned it up until that point. She asked him, would she be able to go back to university that year, or would she need to wait till the following year? And he looked absolutely stricken. And he said, Laura, I'm sorry, you won't ever go back to university. And then he said, have you got any questions? And she said, yes, do you know your scrubs are on inside out? So that was her approach. And the fact that he'd said she wouldn't go back to university, she took as a challenge, essentially. So yeah. She's like, watch me.
This is the When You Die podcast. If it has to do with death and dying, we're talking about it. I'm Johanna Lunn, your host today.
With me today is Nicola Nuttall, a mother of two living in northwest of England. Her life and the life of her family was dramatically altered when at the age of 18, her daughter Laura was diagnosed with glioblastoma, a stage 4 brain cancer. Nicola, welcome and thank you so much for joining me today. I'm so curious about your journey over the last 4 years, has it been?
Mm-hmm.
And how Laura was just starting university when she was diagnosed. And I just can't imagine what that was like for you and the family. Can you share a little bit of your journey?
Thank you for asking me. Yes, Laura had literally just been parceled off to university. We'd bought all the things she needed, took her down to London where she was studying international relations. And it felt like it was the start of a new era. She'd actually spent the summer in Chicago working on the midterm elections, which was a placement that she'd found for herself. So she was already moving away, getting independent and finding her own feet. She had been down in London probably 6 weeks. And during that time, she'd mentioned having a few headaches, but nothing that seemed significant because I've always had migraines. And so I just thought, oh, maybe you inherited that. Unlucky for you. And she joined the Royal Navy University Corps and they sent her for a medical. And at that medical, they identified some pressure behind her eyes. It was just in a high street chemist shop and said, you need to go to the hospital and have that looked at. But she didn't go immediately. She went back and did a presentation. And then she went to tell the shop that she'd just started working that she couldn't work that night because she was very diligent. And when she went to the hospital in London, they said, well, I can't really see anything. Everything looks fine, but we'll refer you for an appointment in a few weeks with a neurologist. That was on a Monday night. And on Tuesday, I phoned to see how she was and she didn't pick up the phone. And when she did eventually make contact, she had a really bad headache and felt really sick and couldn't bear the light and couldn't get out of bed. So the combination of the swelling or the unidentified papilloderma behind her eyes plus this symptom immediately made me think that there was something seriously wrong. So quite late at night, I got a train down from where we are in the Northwest down to London, which is about 3 hours. It was after midnight before we got to her. She wouldn't answer the flat door, so we had to get the security guard to break in and just basically took one look at her and took her straight to an A&E department, an emergency room, where she was scanned that night. And we were told that it looked like she had possibly 2 brain tumours at that point. So I was down there with Laura's sister, Gracie, her younger sister. We phoned Mark and told him what the situation was. That's my husband, Laura's dad. And he drove down and we basically packed up that room that we only just unpacked and brought her back home and then started on this unimaginable journey dealing with a diagnosis we didn't really understand. It took a while before we even realized that a brain tumor like that could be cancer because no one really talks about brain cancer. It's not one you hear about very often. Within 2 weeks, she was scheduled for surgery. And on the morning of the surgery, we went to wake her up because it was an early appointment and she was lying with her eyes open in bed. And Mark thought she was just a bit anxious and so left her to just get herself ready and get downstairs. And then a bit later, we realized that although she was staring at the ceiling, she was completely unconscious. Mm-hmm. We couldn't basically break through at all. So then we had to phone an ambulance to our nearest hospital, and then another ambulance. She had a huge tonic-clonic seizure and remained unconscious for the whole day. So it was really touch and go whether they'd even be able to do the surgery. Fortunately for us, they did, and she came round, and she was actually, she bounced back really quickly, and we felt like we'd won the war, and although it was really bad, she just recovered really well, so we were feeling very positive. And then a week after, when we had the, obviously, the pathology reports, we found out that it was glioblastoma, which was a grade 4 terminal cancer, and she was given approximately 12 months to live at that point.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And what kind of support were you getting at this time? Because her world is crashing, but so is yours and your husband and your other daughter. And were there people for you? Or
yes, to a degree. I mean, we contacted the Brain Tumor Charity, who have been really good since then, actually. They've been really supportive and helpful. There's kind of two separate strands. One is you're desperately looking for options and cures and things that are going to help and things that are going to actually make things better. And also there's the emotional devastation. But I think as the parent, you're very much trying to just be strong for everybody, because my parents were devastated. My husband was devastated. My daughter was devastated. And obviously I was as well. But you have to also not diminish, but try to find a positivity and a route and keep everything together. And there's a whole lot of admin, and there's a whole lot of drugs, and there's a lot of things to be organized with. And it was quite an overwhelming time. You're just bemused, really, by the situation that you find yourself in. So I spent a lot of time through the night researching treatments and reading white papers that I wasn't really educationally able to understand what a lot of these things were going on about at that point, but just looking for anything that we could do to make things better than they appeared to be. Because as far as I was concerned, we were making huge leaps and bounds in cancer treatment. So why was this a 12-month prognosis for someone that was 18 years old? It just didn't make sense to me. I just thought there has to be more that we can do here. I mean, we live near a very good cancer hospital, and in my head, I thought they were going to say, don't worry, we have this amazing treatment and that amazing thing, and we'll be able to do this proton beam and everything will be fine. And actually, there really wasn't that. It was just 12 months and we'll do what we can to make those as easy as possible. In that meeting, when we found out the really bad news, the surgeon described it as having tentacles in Laura's brain. And she said, so like a cancer? And he said, yes, exactly like a cancer. But no one had mentioned it up until that point. She asked him, would she be able to go back to university that year, or would she need to wait till the following year? And he looked absolutely stricken. And he said, Laura, I'm sorry, you won't ever go back to university. And then he said, have you got any questions? And she said, yes, do you know your scrubs are on inside out? So that was her approach. And the fact that he'd said she wouldn't go back to university, she took as a challenge, essentially. So yeah. She's like, watch me. She's now had 4 surgeries. She's had almost 2 years of chemo, 30 plus another 10 fractions of radiotherapy. But she did go back to university. She went to Manchester and did a degree in philosophy, politics and economics, and graduated last summer with a 2-1, and sent him a photograph of herself in a gown with a hat on.
That's amazing.
She's a very determined person.
That is so great. And wow, too, because she must have really gone for it.
Yeah, so it's really tough. Because obviously she'd been at university through COVID. She didn't want to live at home, even though she could feasibly have managed it. She wanted to live in halls and be a student as she was. We were also going out to Germany for treatment roughly every 6 weeks. So she was away for a week nearly every month. Actually finished the degree and get a really good grade, as she did, is incredible because everything was against her. She's taking about 40 tablets a day. She also takes cannabis, which sometimes knocks her out. So she can't really function very well. She can't write essays when she's in that sort of condition. So it's been a massive challenge. And most people would have thought it was not physically possible to do a degree of that complexity, because three subjects essentially. But she's just fiercely determined and wanted to achieve that.
And I'm interested too, because it was obviously the hospital treatments, the complementary things, which I do want to let people know that doingitforlaura.com has some information about some of the complementary things that you've been doing, because there's not a guidebook for people that are going through this. So reading stories and things that are working for Laura can be helpful to point people in a direction that might be helpful for them too. But then there was this bucket list that you guys were also so busy with the business of life.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And Laura said it before, she's in some of the interviews that she's done. It's people often don't appreciate the life that they have until it's almost threatened to be whipped away from them. And it really does focus the mind on what you want to do and what you want to achieve in your life. I think we're all guilty of thinking, well, I will, once I've done this, once I've completed this course or lost a stone or gone on holiday or changed job, then I'll live my life. And actually, we're all guilty of wasting time. So easy to do. Because the prognosis was so dire, we just decided that now was the time to do all the things that she'd wanted to do, alongside get a degree. No pressure. So she came up with an initial bucket list of 10 things. I think we managed 9 of the 10 things. However, so many other people got in touch with us and said, I might not be able to help with those things, but how would you like to do this? Or do you fancy going to see this? Or, and it just basically spiraled. And we've had an incredibly busy few years doing amazing things, which sometimes we just look at each other and think, can you believe this is happening? We're actually doing this. And we've spent a lot of time laughing and taking photos and just having the most incredible adventures. And I think it's not always easy to do alongside being really poorly. And it's been very much dependent on how well she's been at that point. But wherever we can, we've always tried to fill the time with good experiences and things that we can then look back on when things are rough. So Laura likes to take a lot of photographs, which when she is feeling ill or she's in hospital, she goes back. She enjoys the memories of those amazing experiences.
Well, that's great. Can you give us an example of some of those?
Oh, well, she had her license taken away, like most people do if they have a brain tumor or a brain surgery. And she loved driving and she'd only just passed her advanced driving test. So she had a bit of an ambition to drive as many things as she could. And I'm going to forget all these, but she's driven, or I don't think driven's the right word, but a Royal Navy warship, motorbike, a tank, 2 HGV trucks, a bus, a tube train, a yacht. Yeah, monster trucks. So she'd done a lot of driving of huge, huge, enormous vehicles, one of which, when she went down to learn to ride a motorbike, she ended up on the back of a world motorbike champion who went round a track on one wheel at 158 miles an hour with her on the back. I wasn't there that day, thank goodness. She's met Michelle Obama. That was really nice. That was really special for her. We traveled to New York to watch Saturday Night Live being filmed because she's a huge Kate McKinnon fan, and she met all the cast. British Airways were having a 100-year anniversary and they did 100 random acts of kindness. And luckily enough, they contacted us and said, we hear you want to cross the equator. Would you like to fly business class to South Africa and go on safari? So we did that. That was amazing. We've stayed in lovely hotels and we've seen great shows. She's met Gillian Anderson after a show. She's been to see Hamilton. We stayed at the Savoy recently. We just live life to the full. We really have. And I don't want that to end, because we're keeping going with bucket lists, because it's important to not just sit and wait, really, for bad things to happen.
Those are amazing. It sounds like you've kind of tapped into a beautiful stream of kindness.
Yes. Yes, we absolutely have. We raised funds so that Laura could have treatment in Germany. It's very expensive. I think we probably spent probably about £250,000 on treatment so far, which we've raised. And once Laura's story became public, we had so much kindness shown to us. It was absolutely mind-blowing. And complete strangers donating money from children, people arranging school events like sleepovers or sponsored walks, to an individual just sending us £10,000. Who didn't know us at all. Just incredible. And there's a British comedian called Peter Kay, who had been in semi-retirement for a number of years, and he came back to do a couple of shows for Laura. That was amazing. And my younger daughter, Gracie, actually got up on stage and spoke and introduced him and talked about Laura. And there was, I think, 4,000 people there at each of the shows. Gosh, some of the events, you have to pinch yourself. And then through COVID, we were struggling to get out to Germany because obviously there were no flights anywhere. And a company heard about our predicament on Twitter, and we needed to get out there because a vaccine had been made and it was time sensitive. And they lent us a private plane. So we were flying on private jets back and forth to Cologne when no one else was traveling anywhere. The moments where we just look at each other and go, can you actually believe this is happening? There has been a lot of light alongside the dark moments, lots of light.
That's so beautiful, really. So beautiful to see the best of human nature in that way, that people can be truly helpful, truly kind.
Absolutely. And as a result of that, Laura wanted to put things back because she feels like she's been so lucky and she struggles. But you could probably build a school in Yemen with this money. Why are people trying to save me? And she found it quite hard to get her head around. Through COVID, we've been helping out at a local food bank because that was really important to Laura. And she wanted, instead of a Christmas present, she wanted us to open up our children's soft play centre to families that were struggling. So we ended up cooking Christmas dinner for 200 people, and we had an amazing grotto on Boxing Day, and all the children got fantastic presents. And now we've done that for 3 years. So that's become a bit of an annual event. And so many people volunteer. They donate food and they want to come and give their time. So she's very conscious that it's important to give back. When you've seen such incredible kindness, it's the least you can do, really.
It's a bit contagious that way.
It is. Kindness is very much contagious. I completely agree with that.
Yeah. Well, I think too that when you do things for others, it feels good. And I think that's something people miss sometimes, is that it works both ways.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And in the meantime, because Laura's story ended up spreading so far and wide, I was getting lots of inquiries from people asking what they should do with a similar diagnosis. And because it's quite a specific disease, you can find information generally about brain tumors, but it's very hard to find positive stories of people doing well. So they would kind of cling to the fact that Laura was still here. And what are you doing so that I know what to do? So we ended up setting up the website, but we also have a support group on Facebook where when people get in touch with me, I add them to the group so that we can support each other. And we arranged a get together. I think we've done two now, just so that we can bring people together and they can feel like they're not alone, essentially. So that's been quite important to us. And we do have a network of people at different stages in this journey. And it's really sad because we lose people all the time with this disease. We lose them all the time. I ran the London Marathon less than 2 years ago now. It would have been 2 years in April. And I had the names of people that we'd lost on my running top and people that were still fighting on my skirt. And since then, I've lost 19 of those names. And it just breaks my heart every time because we get close to the families and we're sharing information and we're fighting with them. But it's such a vile disease and it's so underfunded and understood. And yeah, that's really tough. That's the hardest part, actually, I think, for us.
You mentioned the treatments in Germany. Can you say a little bit more about this vaccine that was made?
Yeah, I mean, the standard treatment for glioblastoma in the UK, and it's slightly different in different countries, is what they call standard of care. So it's surgery if surgery is safe, followed by radiotherapy and chemotherapy. And it hasn't changed in decades. The chemotherapy tends to be one drug, and that one drug is applied to everyone. So it's not particularly personalized to the tumor mutations. It doesn't really reflect the nature of the tumor, because these are very heterogeneous tumors that have got all kinds of different elements in. So it's a very blunt instrument. So Laura's been traveling to Germany, where she has a form of immunotherapy where a virus is injected into her body. And this is a very harmless chicken virus, actually, which happens to migrate tumor cells. So it acts like a highlighter. And alongside that, she has electrohypothermia, which heats the body up. So the body's looking for the source of an infection, and then it finds these highlighted cells in the brain. And alongside that, she had a dendritic cell vaccination, which is a very complicated and expensive procedure where a vaccine is made from the cells in the tumor that's been removed in surgery. So you can only have that if you have suitable amounts of frozen tumor tissue stored and properly saved. And that is a new therapy where obviously that's very personalized, because that's using your tumor to make a vaccine and show the body that that's an alien thing rather than just normal human tissue. So she's had two of those. And now we're looking at a next stage injection of the virus directly into the tumor site. So it will be injected directly into her brain, which is a little bit scary. But she's now had four surgeries. And to be honest, last October, November, the scan looked really bad and it looked like we were going to lose her. And our nurse specialist said, prepare for the worst 2 weeks of your life. And this was kind of October, November time. But a combination of steroids and grim determination, we brought Christmas forward. We had Christmas in November. We also have some Ukrainian guests staying with us for 6 months, and they were with us for that. That was another thing that Laura wanted to do. So we really thought that we wouldn't have her, because radiation hadn't worked and the chemo hadn't worked, and it looked like that was the end of the road. But she bounced back with the horrible steroids, which aren't great, but she's now having a treatment called Avastin that she's having every 2 weeks. And that seems to have taken away the need for the heavy dose steroids. Mm-hmm. And now, as I say, we're looking at this next level treatment with the vaccine. But she's now 4.25 years post-diagnosis, post that 12-month prognosis. So something seems to be working. I mean, it's very hard to say, because she takes lots of supplements, she takes cannabis oil, she's been to Germany. There's no way to isolate what has or hasn't worked. So we just keep doing what we're doing and hoping for the best, really.
And her medical team there, are they supportive of what you're doing, or do they kind of think, oh, well, whatever?
It's a difficult one. And it's difficult for them because with treatments in the UK, everything has to go through a body called NICE, which decides on which drugs are financially worth a shot and which treatments are financially worth a shot. And that's based on trials and the efficacy that's been proven through trials. Unfortunately, because each brain tumor is different in this situation, it's very hard to get good trial data. So it's very hard to get new drugs, which is why nothing's changed in decades. So they're quite restricted by what is permitted to be offered, which is literally just that one drug. So they know that we're doing various things. They know that we're kind of skiing off piste a little bit and making it up as we go along. If you're given a prognosis of 12 months, I don't think anyone can blame you for trying to improve that, to think that that's not actually good enough. If that's all you're promised, if that's all you're given, then surely anybody would think, well, it's worth a shot. It's got to be worth a shot. As long as the side effects aren't too restrictive and you can financially afford to fund it, anything's got to be worth a shot. So they don't necessarily approve of what we're doing. They don't necessarily know everything that we're doing, but they appreciate the situation that we're in, I think. That's probably the best way of putting it.
Yeah, I guess it's I was hoping that some kind of mutual learning would happen. I suppose that's just hard for bureaucracies.
Yeah, I think probably outside of the facts of trials and data, I think the fact that they know anecdotal evidence is useful. It might not show up very well in a paper, but if you know someone that's done well and they did this and they did that, then I think that helps. And I think that we need to be a little bit more open-minded to that kind of data, because really it's only going to be personalized medicine that's going to make the difference for people with cancer, and certainly with this kind of cancer that's so wide-ranging and also so personal. We've started working with a charity called Our Brain Bank that was developed by Jessica Morris, who unfortunately died in January of last year. And she wanted to take glioblastoma specifically from terminal to treatable. And she's done so much work with the Bill of Rights and trying to improve things from where she was based in the US. We're all now trying to work together to really push for the whole genome sequencing. So to get that personalized data, which you can only get if you have frozen tumor tissue. So kind of going back to that stage as well. So when you are doing surgery, that stuff that you pull out that is just essentially medical waste, if you can store it, if you can freeze it, then two things: it gives you the data that you need to know what is driving that cancer, but also it gives you the opportunity, if you can afford it, to make that vaccine using those cells. So they've just really worked on the new website, and there's a whole campaign that's going to be starting to try and push for that, so that people can get the right treatment for their own personal cancer. Because the thing is, the mutations that you might have in a brain tumor could be the same mutations as in a breast cancer. So you need to be treating them with the same drug, not just because it's in one geographical location, giving it the same drug to everybody. And I think that's the direction of travel. But when you read books like The Emperor of All Maladies, you realize how cancer research is still really in its infancy. Although we're making huge leaps and bounds, we've come a long way in a very short time period. We just need to apply that same drive and energy that we applied to COVID vaccines to cancer now. It can be done. We've shown what we can do with when the money is applied. We just need to use that same focus for cancer now.
So what would you say to families who are faced with a similar diagnosis? What is the best advice that you could give a family based on your experience?
I would say find other people. You can't do it on your own. If you're busy and you've got other children and you've got a job that you need to hold down, it's a lot to do. So try and find your tribe and find people who can share with you what they've learned. That's really important. And also, don't necessarily take no for an answer. Trust your own instincts. Getting a diagnosis, even at that stage, is really difficult, because if a teenager or young adult presents with headaches or sickness or vision issues, there's a very long list of things that will be considered before brain tumors. And I've met far too many people who've wasted or had to waste months, even years, trying to get a diagnosis, because there is that thought that if it has hooves, it's going to be a horse. Well, sometimes it is a zebra. And you need to be prepared for the fact that it might be a zebra. And parents know better than anybody. They know if their child's not right. And I think certainly my generation and upwards, we're taught that doctors know everything, and whatever the doctor says will be right. And sometimes you have to challenge, you have to go with your gut or get a second opinion or do your own legwork, go to the optician if you're not getting anywhere with the doctor. Time is really, really important and really valuable, and you need to be able to act quickly and know what you're looking for. So I think that's really important. But once you have a diagnosis, if you want to try other things, or you've heard of things, or you've heard of somebody doing well on something, sometimes you just have to stick to your guns and find a way to access it, because you can get to a point where, well, you did everything the doctor told you to do, but your child died. And that may well be the same case regardless, but at least you feel like you've given it your best shot. That's tricky.
What I'm hearing too is that you don't want to fall into a place of the woulda, shoulda, coulda.
Yeah, Absolutely. That was something that I felt very strongly. I didn't ever want to be at a stage where I thought, do you know what? I wonder what would have happened if we had tried that, or we had tried to raise the money for that, or just had a go at that, because you've got a long time to think about that. And I wanted to feel like we tried everything. We gave it our best shot. And that's what it feels like. We have thrown the kitchen sink at this cancer, and we probably won't win, because very few people get to live a long life with glioblastoma. I think 5% make it to 5 years, and that's tiny. When you look at the overall survival rates for other cancers, it feels just so depressing when things like leukemia and breast cancer and prostate cancer were making huge leaps forward. This is a difficult one. So it's been pushed to the bottom of the pile because the brain's very hard to get to because it has a blood-brain barrier. So it's very difficult to actually get drugs through it. It's designed to keep infections out, so it's very hard to get things through. And that means it's a challenge, and it's a challenge for researchers and people that do want to find a cure. It's difficult, and drug companies don't particularly want to invest in a small cancer that only affects small numbers of people relative to the big ones, but it's still the biggest cancer killer of children and adults under 40, certainly in the UK. So it's the most fatal of the cancers. So surely that should help to focus the mind a little bit.
Right, right. And on the other side of this, how are you taking care of yourself over these 4 years? Because I hear you working really hard and loving really hard and living really hard. But what about you?
Well, I've been writing a lot to get down the things that I feel. And it's funny because I ended up starting a Twitter account to say the things that were too painful to say to the people in my family, because you're trying to keep positive for them. So it was easier for me to kind of rant anonymously where nobody knew who I was. That didn't turn out so well because now it's got 40,000 followers and everyone knows it's me. So that didn't really
matter. Right, and that's scared shit mom Twitter. Shit
scared mom, yeah. That was just me kind of screaming into the void. But I don't run very fast anymore, but I used to run marathons and things and I used to really enjoy that. And I still get out and run, but I don't run so far. But I find that that helps a lot just to give me headspace and thinking time. And listening to audiobooks and things like that. I've got a really supportive family who love to bits, and they do check in on me and obviously keep me positive and have good friends and things. It's difficult though, because when things are really bleak, I think people go, well, you know what? It might not be that bad, or it might be fine. And sometimes it's like, oh, do you know what? It really won't be. But people don't really know what to say to you, do they? They find it really hard. And there's some people that you thought would be kind of right by your side that have literally said, I can't do this. I'm not emotionally equipped to be able to support you. So some people step away and some people step forward. And I guess that's the same for everybody. Some people hide in supermarkets when they see you because they go, oh no, I'm going to have to ask her. And sometimes you'll go to a class, or when Laura just managed to get to a level of stability, I went back to the gym that I was a member of and I was at a Pilates class, and somebody came over to me and she went, are you the one whose daughter's really sick? And I just thought, wow. And there was nothing I could say other than, yes, it is. And whenever you go anywhere, the first question people ask you is, how's Laura? And sometimes I don't want to talk about it because it's too painful and I want to be able to function. And sometimes it's all I want to talk about. So I don't think I'm particularly easy to approach down the aisle of the supermarket. So if somebody wants to run away and avoid me, I completely understand it. It's difficult, isn't it? It's difficult for other people to cope with anticipated grief or just the whole soul sucking, going back to the hospital every day for a month, well, 6 weeks for radiotherapy. It's exhausting. And you can't really make small talk because your life's just been overtaken by this great big monster that's just swallowed everything up. But I have another daughter who's, this happened when she was 16 and she's now 21. So it's been through a really key part of her life. And she's just not had me around in the same way that she would have had normally. She actually drew my attention to a TED talk about glass children, which really, really touched me. And it was about the fact that if you're the sibling of somebody that's poorly or has behavioral issues or mental health issues, you become invisible. People look through you. People ask you, the first question they'll ask you is, how's your sister? And she's had her own needs. And that's been really challenging for her. She and I have been pulling in opposite directions sometimes, and she's really needed me. And she's found that I've not been available emotionally or physically. We had to cancel a trip, but we made it. And we recently went to New York for 5 days and had a brilliant time. And it was fantastic not to be constantly talking about Laura or talking about cancer. So there are many challenges, and keeping the rest of your family intact at the same time as dealing with this has been really tough. It's a challenge.
There's no question that that is a challenge. And I know that when you were talking about how awkward it is, like in the grocery store, if someone sees you coming, they might go and hide because they don't know what to say. But what do you say? Just hi?
Well, that's the thing. I wouldn't know what to say to me either if I saw me, if I wasn't this person, if it was somebody that I knew. I don't know what I'd say to them either, right? Because you never know what traumas they've gone through that day, right? Or what's on their mind, or what the doctor's just said about the scan. And gosh, I'm in this and I don't know what to say half the time. But from the outside, it's a nightmare, really. It's just a minefield. But I guess somebody said to me, asking, how are you today? How are you doing today? Is probably the best approach. So rather than touch on kind of where are you in this grand scheme of trauma and nightmares and hellish landscapes of hospitals and treatments and things, how are you today? Today I'm good because it's pancake day and we're going to have pancakes for tea. Just bring it back down to the micro. That's probably the safest thing to do, really. Or just maybe we should just wear a badge that says, today I'm good, you can talk away, or don't approach, like you would on a dog that's aggressive. Do not approach very quickly. Liable to snap. I know
that's actually kind of brilliant.
The Good Grief Trust have little brooches, little badges that have an umbrella on them, which they're trying to introduce that would show somebody's dealing with their own grief and maybe to be a bit gentle with them. And I think that's a lovely idea. So, because you have no idea, you can't tell that smiley person next to you in the queue might be having the worst day ever.
Right.
Person that you're having difficulties with, or that's just pulled out on you, they might have just, something awful might have just happened to them. Or I guess we just all have to be a bit kind, don't we, to each other. Yeah, sometimes I really do want a big badge that says, let this woman get her shopping and leave without approaching.
That's right. Just
step away.
Step away. That's right. We never know what's going on with another person, do we? We just never know.
And so we make assumptions. That's the thing, isn't it? If we treat everybody like that, then that will be one thing. There was another person from our brain tumor community, a girl called Amani, who was 23, and she died a year ago today. And her parents have introduced an idea that this week we all do something kind every day for Amani. So we're all trying to do kind things for her. But we should be kind every day, shouldn't we?
Yeah, that's true.
I bought Amani's breakfast yesterday, and today I bought lunch for a homeless man, and tomorrow I'm taking donuts to the nurses.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Little things.
Isn't that the business of living, really?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Grand gestures are all well and good, but just little things. We all do little things.
Yeah. Even in the grocery store, smiling at the checkout person who's just been ripped in half by somebody who's didn't get the price of bananas they were looking for.
Absolutely. In this country, couldn't find tomatoes because they're all out of stock, and people are definitely grumpy at the moment. So just be a little bit kind. It goes a long way, actually. And it's contagious, as we said at the beginning. If you're kind to somebody, they'll be kind to somebody else. Pass it on. Share the love.
Well, that's a really wonderful place to sort of end this conversation. Pay it forward, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm really grateful that you took time to talk with me today. And I think that you're a real inspiration for a lot of people. I'm grateful for that. So thank you.
Oh, that's really kind. Thank you so much for asking and for listening to me, because I do tend to rant on a bit.
No, you're just perfect. You're just perfect.
This conversation is brought to you by the When You Die Project. From existential afterlife questions to palliative care and the nuts and bolts of green burial, if it has to do with death, we're talking about it. WhenYouDie.org.